Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Lew Lind, BEM, the man who was the major force in creating the NHSA and its first president. In this address, he tells of his exploits as a prisoner of war in Crete. It was recorded 7th of December 1973, and duration is 43 minutes.
British intelligence system through the Mediterranean countries, particularly the Greek Orthodox countries, was a navy responsibility. Still is. And in 1941, the Navy had its intelligence system working in the occupied countries of Greece, Yugoslavia, and countries through there within weeks of their occupation by the Germans. Now, I was captured, as most of you know, at Vitimo in Crete, and from there I was taken down to Kinnear and put in the prison camp there, and spent some months working on the aerodrome at Malmö, and during that period, strangely enough, most of the troops there were experienced the usual pangs of POWs. They were subjected to every indignity that the captor could think of. They were systematically starved and overworked, and by this means the idea was to break their spirits. And they did, strange enough, break a lot of spirits. But my main concern was my stomach rather than my spirit. And after a couple of months there, I decided, well, it wasn't worthwhile starving in this particular prison camp, so I quickly found a method of getting out of the place, which was down a sewer, under the wire, and up the sewer on the other side. So the first occasion I got out the prison camp was purely in search of food. So I got out at night, and two other fellows wandered about 5 or 6 miles of the hill, found a village, and which had some livestock, and I think we caught about a dozen scrawny fowls, wrung their necks, tied them round their belts, came back to the prisoner of war camp, broke in through the wire again, and everything was dandy, sat down and we ate our, had our chooks the next day, and it was splendid. So about a week later, the wandering feeling came on again, so off we went, down the sewer, up in the hills, and on this occasion we struck a village where there was a pig with some small piglets. And it shows that even though you're an Australian, you can be terribly ignorant of how to kill a pig. Now, as you recall, I'd been army, and we'd been issued with these jackknives, and the jackknife, of course, had this instrument on the end, the pig stabber. So I thought, well, that's how you kill a pig. So I grabbed one of these piglets, put my boot on it, and started working on it straight with this pig stabber. Well, I don't think any animal showed such resistance as these pigs. In the end, we clobbered them with a couple of rocks and took them back into the camp. So, once again, we got back in quite okay. But the third time, we went out, come back with fowls, and the return through the wire was made opposite the camp commandant's residence, which was situated in the compound. And what we did there was to get through the two aprons of wire and then into the camp commandant's backyard under the foundations of his house and into the prison camp, because the guards were didn't worry too much about that particular area. So it's probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, we got through the first wire, and anyway, one of these belly fowls which I'd wrung its neck hadn't been completely run. The result was that in the middle of the wire, the fowl came to life and squawked, and of course along came the guards, and I was caught, and the guard had no sense of humour. He had me down on my knees, even offered let me say my prayers, which I didn't say, because I started yelling at the top of my voice for the camp commandant, who was within about 50 yards. He came out and gave me a thorough dressing down, forfeited the fowls, and he said next time, well, I won't come out. So anyway, next time I didn't bother remaining in the prison camp. I broke out about 10 days later with three other companions, and strange enough, the times that we had got out before had been without problem, but when we came through the sewer vent, which was our exit, we were sighted, and there was a vineyard immediately sloping up the hill from the point we got out, and of course we got sprayed with the machine guns from the tower, and we spent the next 2 hours, it was like fairly late in the afternoon, we got out, spent the next couple of hours in a hide and seek through this vineyard with guards chasing around the place, but fortunately the vines in those countries are grown not along trellises as they are here, but they're grown in holes in the ground, and they're very bushy, and we succeeded in wrapping ourselves around some of these vines, and we eluded the dairies until darkness, and we made our way inland. Well, wandered all night. Next day we were getting up into the higher country, and none of us spoke Greek, had no food, had no money, and anyway, we discussed what we'd do when we first met the first Greek, whether we should hit him over the head or whether we should make friends or anything. Anyway, the first fellow we met him quite by surprise. He came round a corner of rocks, and he was as surprised as we were. We're still in our uniforms, and he happened to be a very friendly type of fellow, so sat down, opened his dilly bag, and brought out some of that everlasting bread, which you can't eat, it's made like a rock, and about some cheese, some wine, and he set us on the road. Well, we remained together only for about 3 or 4 days. One of the problems with prisoners of war, when they make escapes, everyone's got different ideas. The island at this point was about 30 miles wide. Our original intention was to walk across it that night, but we didn't really appreciate the geography of Crete, and until you really experienced it, it's something hard to believe, because to make 2 miles forward, you make 4 miles backwards. It's straight up and it's straight down. And anyway, after 2 or 3 days, we were exhausted and were about a third of the way across. And we were camped close to a village which was supplying us with food. But it is in a very bad position. It is close to a path used by German patrols. So we decided we'd break up, so I was the first to leave the group, and I headed across the island, and we agreed we'd meet at a little village called Suya, and I would wait a week there until the first fella come. Well, I waited a week, nobody turned up, and so I started a series of wandering through the island. After the first few weeks, I realized there's no future in wearing a uniform, so I got rid of the uniform and got into Greek clothing. Within a week, I'd learnt enough of the language for people to know what I wanted, because if you have a requirement, you can't speak the language, well, you soon learn it. So within a week, I found I could get along quite well. The people were particularly friendly, and at that stage, they weren't as concerned as they did develop later about the Germans, although German patrols were scouring the island, rounding up stragglers who hadn't been captured, and they had introduced a bounty on British troops in the island. I think it was worth in the beginning about 1,000 drachmas, because the inflation that ruled there, 1,000 drachmas would probably buy you 10 woodbines. So that's how much value they put on us in the beginning. It went up to a much higher figure later, which we were quite pleased with that it did go up higher, because we felt we were worth more than a packet of 10 woodbines. So anyway, when I started wandering, at one stage I met up with another Australian, and we found he had a terrific idea. There was a small port called Polyacre, about 5 miles from where we met, in which the Germans had 2 e-boats. Now, his plan was to get down there in dark, swim out to the e-boats, board the e-boats, overcome the sentry for the sentry in it, take off in the e-boat, and head back to Alexandria. So, anyway, we arrived at Polyacre, and it's one of those little Cretan villages which you approach, suddenly you come to the edge of a cliff and it goes sheer down about 2,000 feet to the water, a few houses at the bottom, and then the water. So anyway, that night we did go out. I think I still had that little jackknife, the pig stabber, and he had a little club he'd made. So we swam about 400 yards out this e-boat, and I had very little knowledge of e-boats at that stage, and I can assure you that in the dark there's nothing bigger than an e-boat when you're in the water. So we swam along one side of it, and there was no way of getting up. So anyway, after frolicking in the water for a while, we decided that we wouldn't take the e-boat, it wasn't worth the risk, so back we went. Well, this particular cave was full of ideas, and that he didn't get much of an opportunity to exploit them, because about a fortnight later he went down with pneumonia. Now, we're in an area up in the Wright Mountains there, well, there's no medical service whatsoever, and to complicate it further, he had yellow jaundice, which was quite common because of diet on the island at that stage. So the villagers in this village of Salee sent down for the local bootmaker, the cobbler, and he was the cove that did any jobs that were wanted to be done medically. And I can still remember this cave arising one night, and I laid this fellow out on a table like this and stripped him off, and laid him on his stomach. The cobbler brings out a bootmaker's knife and a razor blade, and he worked on his back first, and he would have made 500 or 600 cuts, little cuts all over the place. And then he got a glass, put it in hot water, and then he started sucking the fluid out of this fellow's body. Strange enough, this worked. I didn't remain long enough to see it, because the next morning a German patrol came into the village and I went out the other end. But I didn't meet the cave for about 15 years later, and there was a knock at my door, Lane Cave there, and a fellow was standing there. He said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "I don't think I've ever seen you in my life." And I said, "Why should I remember you?" From a Cretan who he'd written to. and who got my name, and by chasing around eventually he found me. But he did recover from the pneumonia, and he wandered around for about another 5 months, and a patrol caught up with him. He shot through the knee and captured. And when I met him, although he was only about 41 that age, he was retiring. Although the Germans had done a good job, his leg was withering from this gunshot wound he got in the leg. And it just shows a coincidence you can get there. Well, I wandered, I suppose, then up and down that island. I crisscrossed it, I went always, went to various beaches where people told me there were boats. I did find boats, but most of them the Germans had put holes through them you could walk through. And I had various experiences. And talking about boats, although it was 280 miles of open sea from Crete, the nearest shore of Africa, one cove from the 2nd 11th Battalion actually did make this voyage. He made it in a about a 12-foot boat with a couple of planks missing in the bottom, which he'd patched up with canvas. His water was contained in two kerosene tins. Took no food. It took him 2 weeks. And 2 weeks or more, it might have taken more than that, but he was picked up eventually after the boat had foundered some miles off the coast of Libya. He tied himself to two tins. He was picked up by an Australian patrol which was operating behind the German lines in Libya at the time, and they found him unconscious on the beach. He was taken back with them. He recovered, and but it just shows you that he was a cove that had no idea of navigating, of sailing, of boatmanship or anything, and yet he made this voyage across. He received the DCM for that exploit. But anyway, I wandered on around the place there. The weeks seemed to go by. I became more experienced in talking to Greeks. As a matter of fact, most of them that I was consorting with were brigands, and I got along very well with them. Everyone had a vendetta against somebody else. As a matter of fact, a village possibly less than half a mile away wouldn't speak to the village you were in, and if they got the opportunity of cutting someone's throat in that village, they took a delight in it. Their hobby was to tear down from the mountains, try and run off 50 or 60 goats, and this went on continuously.
And home with them, I
gather. Yeah. Well, I joined with them. It was fun, and of course, when you're young, it's enjoyable. Now, in this period, I had two very close scrapes, and the Germans had by this stage woke up that the best way of tracking down people like myself was by sending some of their blokes in, posing as people like myself. So there were Germans sent into the hills there who'd come along and walk into a village and say, Ido Ostalusta, and the Greek, well, the Greeks probably didn't know much about it then, and had that talk, New Zealand, and the Greek adventure would say, oh, there's a New Zealander down in the cave, down in the bottom of the stone, so on. Before they knew it, a German patrol had grabbed them. But strange enough, as my first scrape there came in a village called Costa Jericho, which was one of those fairy tale villages perched on the top of a hill like that, which you wound around, and Costa Jericho is right on the top. And I arrived there late in the afternoon. I went through the usual preamble, and the villagers responded very well, because they still in those areas kept up the old customs. The women would take off your shoes and socks, wash your feet, and they were really hospitable people. But it so happened that there was an Englishman, English soldier, in this village. And I hadn't been there about more than an hour or so when he turned around to Greeks and said, look, this bloke is a German. and I was consequently locked up in this little room, and anyway, I could hear them talking outside and talking. I was getting windy. So during the night, I found a highlight in the room, and I managed to open this highlight, and that highlight, when I dropped from it, the drop kept going down the hill, which I reckon was something like about 3,000 feet of screw. I got out of all that, but I rolled down and rolled down until I got to the bottom. Now, the second occasion was some months later, and before I go on to that, I'll take to another village, a village called Strate, and give back the original subject which I was talking about. And I was at this village, wandering this village, the Strate, which is just very close to the ancient ruins of Knossos, just out of Heraklion. And it was a fairly well-to-do village for that area. There was wrought iron gates, there was a sign of glass in windows and things which you didn't see in the higher villages up on the hills. And they were having a church service. And one of the Greeks, I never went near their churches because I didn't understand what they were talking about in any case, I could see. And after church service, one of the Greeks came out, a fellow called Andreas, he said, the Papa wishes to see you. And anyway, the door opened and in walked the Papa. And the thing which I should explain to you before I go any further is that in these country districts of countries like this, the person who wields the most authority is the priest. He's the fellow that can repeat three times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and you're divorced. He's the same bloke who can turn around and say, well, the land you stole off Ralph Pound, you can give him twice as much back. I knew these word went, whereas the police force was non-existent. It is too dangerous for policemen to go in the area, so everything revolved around the priest, and the priest was the main man, and he's usually a very tall Greek, riding a very small donkey, with a red blanket on it, something like this colour, and his legs trailing along the ground, with about 8 retainers going along, throwing holy water ahead of them. And anyway, as I say, this evening, door opened and in walked this priest. And this fellow was, I suppose, about 6'4", massively built, hair down to here, a beard down mid-chest, had the round Greek hat on, the long gown, sat down, looked at me rather oddly, which wasn't strange because at that stage I hadn't washed my face for about 5-6 months. I hadn't had a shave or a haircut for nearly 9 months, and I looked as dark and probably as dirty as any Greek you could find. But it was completely intentional. And anyway, he immediately started off in talking to me in English, and to me, Oxford English, you know, real college English, and he said, you're an Australian, and various questions he asked me. He eventually got on to Sydney. He said, you come from Sydney? I said, yes. He said, well, what is the third street on the left going towards the railway from the quay or something of that nature, and questioned that time. And anyway, eventually he satisfied with me, and I started working for him. And it wasn't a very difficult job, because at that stage I had been moving around with a group of young Greeks who, I suppose you'd call them criminals at this stage, because we'd probably started the genesis of making raids on German stores. We were even making raids on the Greek monasteries, because the guerrilla movement in Crete started over cigarettes, because everyone was dying for a smoke. And the monopoly of the tobacco trade was held by the priests, who were the only people who grew tobacco leaf. And the leaf was contained in a walled monastery, and the only way you could get in there was to raid it at night, and you could get a shotgun blast in the seat of your pants quite easily, because these blokes didn't muck around when you touched the tobacco leaf. So that's how it started. From there, it escalated a bit further to creeping into a German camp and seeing what you could pinch when they were on parade. Then it went a bit further into ambushing small groups of Germans, particularly when they're going for a walk or something like that. Well, the system developed from there on until a guerrilla movement went. So anyway, I started working for the priest, who was in fact a fellow called Commander Poole, who was known to quite a number of Australian officers in the Mediterranean at that time. And
was he a priest, or was he just Commander Poole?
Commander Poole was an ordained priest. He was a lecturer in Greek theology at either Cambridge or Oxford University. And most of those people who they used in this business were. He was marrying people in these areas I was moving through. He was christening kids, he was doing everything that a priest should do, and they accepted him. He spoke the language perfectly, and to speak the language of those areas, you've got to be now a bit more than speaking Greek, because it's quite a dialect. They speak a lot of Turkish in it. And anyway, some of the first jobs I did was to go into places like cities like Canea or Heraklion, and gather bits of information for him, different units there, different types of aircraft, different ships and things. And what we used to do, I'd go with a Greek boy, we'd pick up a fruit barrel on the edge of the city and load up with tomatoes or whatever was going. We'd wheel it through the city and we'd sell it in the gateways of the barracks. And there was no problem whatsoever. Nobody ever questioned you. And you had your military police of sentries going through there. You'd wander through, and despite the fact that at that time they had issued identity passes on the island, which we didn't have. But it was after one of these forays I was going to tell you about that my second narrow escape occurred. I was heading back from Canea down to Thrattine, where the priest had his headquarters, and I'd hitched a lift on a cart. There's practically no mode of transport, and it is distant about 60 miles, and we're on the coast road, not in the mountains, and we came across a roadblock which was manned by the Jerry's, and I thought, oh well, I've bluffed my way through them before, so let's not worry. And everything went well, and we pulled up, and the Greek yelled at the top of the voice, "He's an Australian."
Oh, yeah.
Fortunately, there was a very heavy clump of bamboo next, right beside the road, and I dived into this, through the bamboo, across the beach and into the water. And I cleared off into the water, swam out, and came ashore a bit further along. But this is the type of operation I was involved in. I had nothing to do with the more detailed intelligence work that Commander Poole was doing. He had communications, of course, with Cairo, and his signal people were located very deep in the mountains where the Germans found it hard to penetrate. But I might add one other experience which happened at this time, and this was just out of Heraklion, you know, an area which is renowned for its windmills. and the magnificent area, little villages scattered everywhere, quite built up, white villages, olive groves, vineyards, and of course you get probably a bit too cocky as you go on. Well, I went to this particular village around noon one day, and my clothes were in tatters, and one of the Greeks I met said, well, look, let the women wash your clothes. They're dirty, they've got, you're probably lousy, which I probably was too. And so he said, while they're washing the clothes, you can come and sit down in this little hut in the olive grove, which I did. And I'd been sitting there about 2 hours without a stitch of clothing. And anyway, I heard a truck approaching up the road to the village. And the truck had a group of about 12 German soldiers in it, and on the running board, this Greek. So I said, well, what in the hell am I going to do now? I've got no clothes. So this particular grove of olives was a very old grove, very big trees and very bushy trees. So I shinned up the nearest tree and I went up as far as I could get. I wrapped my legs around the tree and I hung on there, and down came the German troops and the Greek, and they beat through the place. They kicked over the little hut I'd been in, couldn't find, and then they got the Greek and I nearly fell off the tree. Well, they kicked him to pieces there underneath me for bringing him from about 3 miles off, and there's no sign of the Australian. And anyway, when they cleared off, it didn't get me out of a predicament, because for the rest of the afternoon, I didn't have any clothes, and I was in a fairly populated area, and I had to keep moving. And there's little stone walls about that high dividing the field right through that place. Well, you'd be creeping along one side of the wall when you'd find out that you're on the wrong side of the wall. So then you'd have to jump that wall, which went on the whole afternoon until nightfall came, and then I succeeded getting into a village and stealing some clothes off a lion, and off we went. But I remained with Commander Poole probably about 5 months. And the last job I had was bringing in other Australians or New Zealanders I could find. So we wandered all over the island, and eventually we gathered together about 60 Australian, British and New Zealanders, including one fellow who the Greeks had taken his leg off and looked after him all this time. Another fellow we brought in, he died on us. He was suffering from European malaria, which is pretty sickening. And we gathered them in a very big cave, not far from Mount Etna, and we assembled them there, and well, eventually the arrangements were made for us to go off the ship. Strange things happen with troops in areas like this now, and sails. We did have a sail amongst this group, strange enough, and a few Air Force fellows, and we had three of the original commando officers. And the commando officers were immaculate. And they came along with their haversacks with cigarettes in and other little luxuries, which the troops hadn't seen for a while. Well, the New Zealanders, of course, immediately demanded that everything be shared. And it ended up quite a riot there. And I can still remember the commander officer putting, two commander officers, trying to put under arrest something like 20 big Kiwis. And it didn't work. But anyway, Commander Poole eventually solved the problem. He sent the commandos away and separated them. But Commander Poole was taken off the island about this period, and a submarine was sent over, and we were in the group which were taken off. Now, the strange thing about it was that this was supposed to be a very secret operation, the evacuation of our group from Crete. We're in an area of probably just opposite of Rathgon, and the bay chosen, strange enough, had two headlands which both were manned by German troops. There was a small battery on one, and there was a searchlight a little bit further along, but they selected this bay because the depth of water was sufficient for the submarine to come almost into shore. And although this was a secret operation which had been arranged by our intelligence fellow in Crete, I think every Cretan for miles around knew it was on. And they took a particular interest in this for one good reason. And the good reason was revealed to us when we got down on this beach, which we did eventually after many false alarms. And as soon as we arrived on the beach, Commander Poole turned around and he said, "Well, you're not much good taking the clothes away from Crete, and that's what the Cretans have assembled for." And it was like a white elephant's door. You gave your boots to the family who had looked after you best. You gave your shirt to someone else. Not that they were worth anything. The beach had no soles on them. In pitch black there, and arguing and tearing at this clothing. But, anyway, the submarine appeared about just after midnight, and I don't think anyone knew it was there until a sailor just walked out of the water up on the beach with a lifeline on him, and he spoke to Commander Poole, and they brought in a little raft shortly afterwards and took out the fellow with one leg and a couple other sick, and the rest of us told to swim out the lifeline, and which we did, and I was towards the end of the line, and there's quite a chop, I know. I can still recall when we got out there, the same problem arose with the submarine which arose with the e-boat, because a submarine, when you're swimming in the water, is a hell of a way out of the water. It was covered with this black gooey oil, and it was pitch black, and I swam the whole length of it before I could get out, and still couldn't find any place to get up on board. And anyway, I thought, well, there's only one way, so I yelled out hoy, and the voice yelled out hoy back. I pulled up, and there's two sailors on the conning tower there with I don't know what they had in their hand, a club or something, shot a couple of questions to you. If your questions were right, you went down the conning tower. If the questions weren't right, you went over the side again. There's no mucking around. So, anyway, we got down below, and 60 of us, without clothing, covered in this black grease, because the time you got over the side of the thing, you had black grease from head to foot. Most of us were in the condition I told you previously. We hadn't had a haircut or shave or wash in probably about 9 months by that stage. We stunk like high heaven, and the poor submariner had to put up with us on the 2 or 3 days that it took across to get across there. But we're taken alongside the submarine depot ship, or whatever, mothership, and as soon as we got on deck there was a great fatigue of sailors lined up, and it speaks well for the organisation of the Navy that two sailors would grab one of us and dump us in this canvas bath, and they scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. Well, they'd whipped it out of the bath, and by this time, I might add, most of us were pretty scrawny. I can hold around about 7 stone at that stage, and I wasn't in bad condition. I'd been eating well towards the end, but some of them were just skin and bones. We whipped off then out of the bath onto a stool and two sailors who didn't know how to give a haircut chopped your hair off. We're outfitted in the most gawkish English uniforms, which looked absolutely unnatural, Bombay bloomers, the whole lot, and the forage cap. We're taken off at night time, put in a special carriage on the train down to Cairo, taken to the Citadel, which was our intelligence headquarters there, and we remained there about 3 or 4 weeks, and it was really good because we got the best of everything, and we found out that Commander Poole seemed to have an endless supply of cash, and if we went into town, we had to go in for another. We were in with an officer and me, admittedly, but I was saying to Commander Poole, but what do we take with us was good enough for £5 note. So this went on for about a month. I was a Commander Poole running out of money, or they'd finished with this. We're whizzed off to the job. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is a fill-in. Commander Poole, but what do we take with us was good enough for £5 note. So this went on for about a month. I was a Commander Poole running out of money, or they would finish with this. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is a fill-in. I'm sorry our speaker didn't arrive. Something untoward has happened, but I thought, well, it's difficult to find something to interest you at a moment's notice. So thank you very much.
May I ask a question, please?
Yes.
The name of the submarine?
I don't know the submarine yet. Now that's good. Now the
we weren't
interested in the name, honestly.
Really?
And I don't even know the depot. I could find it out by looking it up. See, but Well, I wrote a book about it shortly after the war, and
I bet they put the squeeze on you then.
Well, this book was about 300 pages, and one of the conditions was that it was had to go to England Convention before it was published, and it was published.
I bet they put the squeeze on you then.
Well, this book was about 300 pages, and one of the conditions was that it was had to go to England for censoring before it was published. And it was published.
You had about 3 pages.
No, I had 110 pages. And this was many years ago that book was published, but quite recently I obtained the copyright back. When I say recently, in the last 18 months, they wrote back to the UK and said, well, look, a lot of time's gone by. Can I now have the copyright of the jolly thing? Can I publish it? And I got a letter back saying the same conditions which applied to Elementary in 1946 still apply.
I know on one occasion I was part of a covering party. In fact, I intended to ask you, remember, do you have anything to do with the couple of English Johnnies that got hold of the general in charge of Creek?
No, they came much later. They operated in 1944.
That was a commando raid then?
Yeah.
No, they were not commando officers.
No, I know, that was in the form of a commando raid. There was about 15 people involved in that.
Only two Englishmen went across, the covering party that went across in the south. When they brought him out, they had nothing to do with it, because I was part of the covering party, and you got cold and miserable, you laid around that beach, and after God knows how many hours, the sergeant came out and said, you can go back on board now. That, like a lot of things, when everything goes according to plan, it's just sheer cold misery and boredom.
It was a very good film, though. Well, my conclusion of all these things which I'm telling you is the amazing ignorance of the average fellow of what he's doing or where he is. Now, none of us had much idea what was north, south, east or west. None of us knew that when the battle was on, that the end of the battle must have ended somewhere, and that wherever that somewhere was would be neutral ground, see? No one, not even our officers, had much knowledge of the hinterland of the place. They had no idea, or very little idea, of the people of the place, because I've read intelligence reports since which suggested that a very strong 5th Column was operating on the island. And it was the last place the 5th Column could have operated, because they were so intensely pro-British. I know they have improved a little bit, but by the way, they would have wanted to improve a lot from those days. But anything else? Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for attending.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.